The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to welcome back our guest this evening. Amy Tan has been to the library more than a few times over the years, so by now, I expect many of you know a good deal about her writing. What you don't know a good deal about is Miss Tan. That's because until now, she has kept the most personal details about her past sub rosa. As with most writers, she refracts her life through her characters, but as Miss Tan said about her memoir in Today's Times, my reluctance is always casting something out there that will be in the public and will be subject to public interpretation. I want nothing of that. It's like taking the mask off, taking your clothes off, and having people say, oh my God, it's nonfiction. And people can make fun of the way you think or say, oh, that was trivial. But I think considering her number of adoring readers, she won't have much cause for concern. Miss Tan will be in the able hands of Laura Kovacs this evening, the producer of our popular backstage video series, 20th and Vine, and she's also the associate director of author events. Please welcome Amy Tan and Laura Kovacs.
Welcome back to the Free Library.
It's great to be here again.
Also, congratulations. Today is the actual publication day for Where the Past Begins.
That's right, the day I dreaded. But you're all here and you're friendly. And
it's an incredible privilege to talk to you, especially today. I just want to take a quick poll of the audience. Who here is holding a copy of this brand new book?
Wow. Ooh. Did they make you buy this to get in here?
We are off to a great start. In describing the book, you said the continuous epiphanies are the reasons you're a writer and always will be. What did you learn about yourself in writing this book?
I can't even begin to tell you all of the things that went on, discoveries that were really awful. For example, that I was not my father's favorite. That's not an epiphany, that's a fact. But the epiphany had to do with this need to belong in a certain place, for example. The epiphany had to do with realizing that all of my imagery and my imagination relates to an emotional core that keeps expanding and becomes more multidimensional. It had to do with seeing my mother in a different way that gave me, made me very much more sympathetic to what she had gone through in terms of loneliness. So it was constant. Every day was an epiphany, joyous, tortuous, life-changing.
Your correspondence with Daniel Halpern is so interesting and revealing. At one point, he writes, I don't need to see your edits. I'll feel them as I read. How was the writer-editor relationship different with this book?
First, you gotta know, Dan Halpern is my editor, but he's also the publisher of Echo. And he's not the usual kind of editor. He's this person who's a poet, a dreamer, and he's somebody I absolutely had to trust with very, very rough drafts. And he believed in me, and he encouraged me. He knew what I was writing before I knew it. He knew I was writing memoir, and he couldn't say the word because he knew I would run off scared. You know, and I always worried that my prose was really, really bad, really trite and rough. And it is. You know, I'm really upset when I read some of these sentences. I should have done two more edits, but he would just say things like that. I will feel them. I will know. I will understand your book even more, and I know where you wanted to go with this. So that's Dan. That's an amazing editor to have. And he helped me with the other book we did together, The Valley of Amazement. This book really is also his book because he guided it so much. He did not use the word chapter because I said, I'm just writing, I'm spinning out material. We're going to decide later what I'm going to do with it. Spontaneously doing this, it's all going to be rough. Do not say anything about it. Do not tell me it's good or bad. Don't tell me what you think it's about. And then he said, fine. And he was forbidden from using the word chapter. And he had to do it. Every now and then, though, he would say, yeah, I read that, and it's really a stunt. Oops, sorry, you know. or he would say something that he talked to somebody about, and I would get very, very upset. So it was just a book between us.
You've mined your past for this book, but even your past from before you were born. Will you explain your theory about how the fictional mind works with memory?
What I discovered, especially in writing this book, is that memory has a lot to do with emotions that are embedded, and that this is true neurologically. And in other ways that memory works. And what I mean by that, you know, take the model of PTSD. It goes into part of your brain known as the amygdala, and it's where every horror nightmare is embedded. And in there, these are stories that have been, you know, they're engraved completely with all the visceral reactions you had as they were happening. They are there, hidden in the amygdala, because they're not a pretty thing to relive, which many people with PTSD know. Fiction is a subterfuge for saying, no, they're still hidden. You're safe. You can go in there. When I start to write fiction, I find I'm going into various directions, and I'm often guided by emotion. And suddenly I find I'm at a place that feels very familiar. And that's part of the epiphany. And what happens is I gain an understanding. It's not a resolution. It's not like one of these movies where somebody remembers the sled and then they're cured, or, you know, that you understand the movie, that it was about this or that. It is simply a larger understanding. And that's an epiphany, the larger understanding. You can still be outraged, pained, and everything, but and that's part of it. So the fiction, because you think you're safe, you give this person a character, and you're observing. You've always observed as a kid. You've all the observations the character has, you have observed, and you're going there. It brings out the memories, but it also drives the fiction. It's a two-way street. It's mutually compatible, mutually beneficial.
After the joy.
Do I sound like I'm crazy? Okay.
You sound very smart.
I think there are a bunch of psychiatrists in there going, oh, yeah. Borderline. Okay.
After the Joy Luck Club, your mother gave you permission to write the truth you write about in the book. She gave you permission to write the truth, to change the past by replacing the power of shame with outrage. Is that an idea you would agree with, writing to change the past?
No, I don't really want to change it. She wanted to, I think what she meant was, in a way, to change our reaction to it, and so that there wouldn't be shame in front of other people, but not for me to fictionally change it and make it a happy ending. She wanted me as a witness and to say, this all happened, you can't change that. That happened, I felt that shame, society was like that, no one can change that. I'm gonna always have that pain and always feel that. But she wanted the witness so that she could come out of it and feel that somebody had sympathy for her. And that's what I did when I was writing. I also felt that when I was writing this book, one of my epiphanies is that I was the witness to my own childhood. And I had to refer to myself in one instance in the third person because I was both the witness and the child again, and I couldn't be both. You know, I had to have that distance where I know I survived as an adult, and I'm looking at it, but and I needed the subterfuge of the third person, although it was just very close to what my experience was. And again, it was to go through that and to understand what happened, and to say, yeah, I deserve to be mad, or I understand now why I have such a strong need for control.
That scene you're referring to is easily one of the most harrowing scenes in the book. I was struck by the writing. First, there's a process of recollection, of transcribing the events as they happened. But then there's the art of writing it. Can you talk about the craft of writing a scene like that?
You know, there wasn't really a lot of craft to it, in fact, because here's another thing I discovered about writing when in this book, and that is that narratives and imagination and all those things that we love about creativity, this ability to spew things in a productive way, have a lot to do with spontaneity. And if you can, when you have spontaneity, one of the things that happens is you shut off self-consciousness. You have to believe that no one is ever going to read this, you know, so there's a lie that you have to have to yourself. And it doesn't have to be a lie, because then you can decide later, I'm never going to show somebody this stuff. And that was what I was hoping when I was writing this book. I kept telling myself, Dan, however, had different ideas. So the spontaneity of letting it come out naturally formed this exercise that became this growing scene of what happened. The scene is based on a very fragmentary memory that I have of being in a car with my mother and her being upset and opening the door, about to jump out to kill herself. You know, in one sense, this was common. She often threatened to kill herself. And, you know, over the life, our lifetime together, I saw it a few times. And you don't need to have, you know, you can have somebody who says it over and over again, I'm going to kill myself. You know, the meat was not done right. I'm going to kill myself. You only need to see your mother do that, try that once, and you quake every single time she says it. So in this memory, I had been talking about the amygdala and how, because I something weird happened, I won't go into it, but something weird happened to me that made me realize how much of these visceral reactions can lead to these narratives. I can pull them out by just following the feeling. As I sat down, I start with the car, and I feel something happening in me. And then after a while, my limbs get cold. And I just keep following it. And I start seeing things. And I, you know, I start getting tight in places. My mother is getting angrier and angrier. And I recognize the signs. And the signs are that she's going to explode. And I'm trying to control it. I can't control my mother, but I can control whether she is going to take me down with her. And I said, look at your hands. Remember this day. Don't forget what she did. And I was supposed to make a fist, but I couldn't make a fist. My hands were weak. And it goes from there all the way through. I'm just writing this, in a fugue state, just writing and writing what's happening, when she opens the door, it's the door's stuck, we're saved. Oh no, she's got this. Oh, the shoe flew off. Oh my God, she's, all the way to the end, and the end was surprising to me. It wasn't, oh, we're saved, now we're going to go home. It wasn't that awful. It was being so mad at my father for trying to comfort her. Why was he comforting her? What about us? I never would have thought of that as an adult. If I had not gone through that again in that particular way, that understanding would not have come back to me. And in the end of this fugue memory, I was asking questions like, what's going to happen when she gets back in the car? Is she going to try again? How is he going to hold on to her? Is she going to get in the back with us? Is she going to talk to us? When is she going to talk to us? Are we going to have to go to bed without eating again? And then it's this, I don't want to know. I don't want to ask questions anymore. I just want to stop shaking. And I was writing this, and I was just shaking, at the desk. And fortunately, Lou came in, my husband, who we've been together 47 years, and he's great. He makes me, when I'm working really hard, he'll make me meals 3 times a day. So he brought me this meal, and I said, no, I need to get out of here. And he said, I'll eat it with you upstairs. And I was sitting there eating and shaking for an hour. The other part of that is I remained angry. And that's what was really so difficult for me with this book, letting go of this book and knowing it was going to be published after a while, because these emotions were very raw. It was like being a kid again and somebody's going to haul you out and show you what your feelings were. I wanted to retreat in the room and read the fiction, go off with Jane Eyre, And so for a while, I kept telling my editor, I hate this book. I hate this book. It was necessary for me to write, but I hate that it's going to be published. And it was coming closer to this date, and I just said, I just have to be the 9-year-old kid and kick my heels and have a tantrum. I needed to be allowed that time to do that. And, somebody said, how do you feel now? Because it's the day before this day. And I said, I've accepted it, in the same way I accept that death will happen. And it's inevitable. You can't stop it. So there it is.
There it is. Going through your father's belongings, you came away understanding that his need to find meaning and show compassion led him to the ministry, and it was those same needs that led you to writing.
Yeah.
In what ways?
My father's needs were based on a number of things. One is that background, his family was, they were evangelical Christians, Methodists. And with that, kind of upbringing. He, I think, had great torment in the fact that he started an affair with a married woman, my mother, who also had 3 children. My mother eventually was jailed and because of this affair, and later joined him in the States. Imagine somebody who's an evangelical Christian being faced every day with a woman who reminds him that he broke one of the 10 Commandments. So he was looking for guidance. He got accepted to MIT. Can you imagine what our family would have been like had he gone to MIT? We would have been well off. We wouldn't have. It just would have been this different life instead of being raised by this impoverished minister. Anyway, what he did, and I'm piecing together a lot of this based on what I found in the journals and in these boxes, is that he needed to find direction, and he heard God telling him that he should join the ministry. This was going to be his meaning in life, to save other people. He used to talk about this, that God gave him this direction. He would say it in, it became a ministry. He would say this in his sermons. And I actually believe this to be literal, that God would speak to you and give you the meaning of your life. One day, I walked up the aisle. You know, they would have these invitations at the end of the service to come up and declare that Jesus is your Lord and Savior. And I pretended that I had heard God tell me that he wanted me to say this out loud. And I walked up, and I knew it was a lie. I had lied in front of my father and the church and God. And God could, he knew. He knew that I was lying. What that did, though, I mean, what was going on in my head, this, instead of God, I had a conscience that would, and a narrator that would observe things and tell me what was going on at the moment they were happening. God was supposed to tell you what to do. I didn't have a God telling me what to do. I got to decide, and then I got to assess that it was a very bad thing that I had done. But the same impulse of wanting to have some kind of guidance in your life, something to believe in, and to believe in very strongly, came from that father with those evangelical beliefs, and it was transferred to me and transformed by myself into a need to have my own, to make my own beliefs, to find them, and to also find meaning in some way. And this notion of meaning has been so nebulous to me. But one of the great parts of it that I think was clarified to me is it had to do with feeling deeply and always asking questions and knowing what I believed, writing it down. If I didn't write down what I believed or felt for the day, those memories of what happened at that moment that I was feeling it, they were like little deaths, and the meaning was to take that all with me, cumulatively, into my life as a whole, and that I would find this to be the guiding force for continuing to look at my life. I would say, you know, if you were to look at things like morals, you know, whether you meaning of your life is to raise good children or to go to Puerto Rico and help, you know, with the people there who've been devastated. Whatever those things are, that it goes back to some basic qualities that we have as people, and that is, you know, the common ones like kindness and love and responsibility. And so we find those in different ways, and it became clearer to me that I would find different meanings for, you know, what that would be, what the direction of my life was.
What has been the impact of secrets, particularly of the women in your family?
Boy, I love secrets because they just give me a lot of material, you know. What's in secrets are, you know, there's a secret because there's a contradiction. There's somebody who's told you this and somebody who's told you that, then they emphasize something. It's very important for you to believe that it was intentional that she meant to die because she put the opium in the sticky rice cake. Sticky rice cakes, you know, they were so sticky you just can't get them out of your stomach once you've swallowed them, and that meant... And then there's my mother who said she never intended to die. She never would have left me. And there's someone else who says it wasn't shame because she already was a concubine to the first wife. She was. When you have contradictions, you know there's a secret going on. And there's, you know, the it isn't what you need to find. It doesn't have to do with the truth, the facts. It has to do with the desire and the need and the necessity, all the emotions that made those things come together. And that's what I like to find, you know, in the secrets. That's what's so great about secrets and putting them into fiction, because I get to explore all the different possibilities. They are all emotional possibilities or, things based on circumstances, not facts.
You've called your grandmother the ghost of your imagination. How did you discover the truth about her life, and what influence has she had on you?
My mother told me when I was growing up that my grandmother had been a widow from a very young age, and her husband died. He was a scholar. He died suddenly, and she was not supposed to remarry. A widow of a scholar should have remained a widow all her life. But she did remarry. She remarried to a wealthy man, so, you know, that wasn't that bad. And she was a first wife, so, you know, that was also okay. But in hearing my mother talk about other stories and about her death and about other people and how they treated her and her discussion about shame and how she refused to be looked down upon, I thought something else is going on here. And I could feel the truth of that because of this hatred that my mother had for condescension, for people being, you know, superficially nice or being controlling in a way. And I started to guess at what the truth was. I was told my grandmother was a very traditional woman. She was quiet. She was a woman of few words, and she stayed at home. And she cried a lot because her life was so sad. Look at me. Am I the kind of person who is a person of few words, who is quiet, who stays at home and cries? I'm like my mother, and my mother certainly was like her mother, to the point that she was suicidal, like her mother. She had a bad temper. I did, in fact, end up hearing about this bad temper. It came out during the writing of the book. I talked to somebody who was a little child living in that house, a mansion. And she didn't hear these things. She overheard the gossip that was said about my grandmother after she died. But it was about her temper and that she ruled the house. She was the fourth wife, not the first wife. There were other concubines above her, but she ruled the house. She was the favorite. And if you didn't listen to her, you'd be sorry. That's what she said. And I thought, that makes sense. That's absolutely true. That's what she passed on to my mother, and that's what my mother passed on to me. And you can ask my husband. That's very true. very stubborn in a way. Very, almost, I think of some of the things I got from them are bad qualities. You know, I'm very unforgiving. I'm not the nice person. You know, you read the Joy Luck Club, you think, oh, she's so wise, and she's like the wise mother, the good daughter, and everything. No, I am unforgiving, I am stubborn, I have obsessions, I can't let go of things, and those are what were passed down to me. So when I write, you know, the person that I think of myself writing for, in order to tell the truth, in order to get to the depth of understanding, it's my grandmother. Or more recently, my mother, who died in 1999.
You've said in the past that you did not intend for the Joy Luck Club to be an immigrant story. But over the past almost 30 years, so many readers have learned about the experience of immigrants and first-generation Americans, but also the very best things taught by great literature: compassion, understanding, empathy. What do you think of the American dream in this political climate of 2017?
How many of you have read my Facebook page? Okay. I'm going to be very measured here, but, you know, we were a family of immigrants who were illegal. My parents were illegal. We were a family of evangelical Christians. We were a family whose my father and my brother died of brain tumors within the same year, and health care was very important to us. I am so concerned about the direction of our country. It has to do with the way people treat each other, which feeds in every way into how we think of what is important for the country, like health care. I think of the party that believes in a different direction is not the soft liberals that have been, that word has been become a dirty word. I would say we are those who believe in a different way. You know, you don't have to label it as a party. You can just say it's the party of compassion. Everything about immigration that I believe, everything about health care, about women's right to choose, about how we treat the rest of the world, it has to do with understanding and compassion. I don't know how we're gonna bring this together, because you know the people are hurting, and I know that the people who say we've had enough, they're hurting, but they just don't realize that what they're hurting about is going to get a lot worse. I'm allowed to say this because, and I ask permission, of the family who lives next door to us. We have a house, and we don't live in that house. This other family does. They're a DACA family. A woman and her husband, college educated, illegal, because they were brought here to this country when they were young. They have two children, college graduates. She is a manager at UC Berkeley School of Business. Great people. He has a degree as well. These are the people. I look at these people and I say, this is like my family. We were illegal. These are the people that this administration wants to get rid of. You know, and that's not the face of the people. You know, this mind that people, some people have of what these horrible immigrants are, these illegal people. Look at me. Look at these other people. You know.
Do you think the role of the writer or of the value of literature is any different now?
You know, I would like to be idealistic and say, you know, now more than ever we need literature. That's the right thing to say. And the fear I have is that we, you know, have lost the impulse to read, to find some kind of commonality. You know, the kind that I found when I was a kid, going in my room and finding friends when I didn't understand what was going on outside. We have social media that's taken the place of a lot of what we would have found in fiction. But yes, if I were to be idealistic, I would say the role of literature, both for readers and writers, is more necessary than ever. Writers of revolutions have always come out with some of the greatest literature of our time. They were they had a reason to write. George Orwell writes about this, you know, why I write. That everything, you know, it has everything to do with what's going on in the world. Now, I have to say that I don't take that as my mantle, that I'm going to be somebody who wants to change the world and call out to the evils of this kind of political regime or something. What I'm doing is much more intimate. And yet, in a way, I think that it addresses the larger nature of politics or war or revolution. Because, it, you know, these things are not masses. These things begin with the individual. And so my impulses are personal, and in a way, they're quite selfish. I'm just writing about questions I have. But I happen to think, because I found through experience, through people telling me, that these are the kind of things that the needs, the questions that others have.
Thank you so much. I have been limited to just one last question, so I'm going to drastically change the tone here. During your time with the Rock Bottom Remainders, you were billed variously as a rhythm dominatrix, second tambourine. And my question for you is, what is the wildest backstage story about the Rock Bottom Remainders?
Oh my God. Where do we begin? The wildest. It was that time we were watching McNeil Lehrer. You know, this is the thing. You know, we're crazy on stage, and I'm wearing this dominatrix outfit, and I'm whipping the boys. They're all bent over, and I'm whipping Stephen King, and everybody thinks this is really great. And, you know, the bad thing is I find out later the boys really liked it, so that... That makes me think, oh, gross, you know. I thought it was an act, but they really liked it. But in our band, you know, because we're of a certain age, there are a lot of them who were in recovery, you know. So there's not a lot of drunken stuff happening, you know. And it was really true when we were on our bus tour. Instead of, you know, if you've seen movies of rock bands and they're all in the bus doing all kinds of things, you know, drugs or whatever. No, in our band, we were watching McNeil Lehrer. The worst thing, I think there was a moment when we were in the bus and that Roy Blunt Jr., and I can say this because he's talked about this, and somebody else, they were on the bus standing on by the door. It was Aretha Franklin's bus. Standing by the door, peeing. As we were flying by at 60 miles an hour. And that was pretty bad, you know, but we were pretty well behaved. You know, we were adults, and I think it had a lot to do with the fact that many of them had already gone through this wild side that nearly killed them. So, yeah.
I'm going to open this up to the audience here. I think most people know how this works. Please raise your hand and wait for the microphone, and then phrase your question as a question. Who wants to go first? Right here in the front row, sir.
Thank you for coming to the library again. I'm curious how your books have been received in China and whether that reception has changed over time.
You know, I used to have this fear that I'd go to China and they would, you know, kick me out for writing things that were not true and also against the government or whatever. Instead, I was very surprised that I had readers very much like readers in the States and in other countries who said, you captured exactly what happened in my family. It was moving to me. I had somebody who said what you described during the war of leaving a child behind out of necessity. That's what happened to us. How did you know? What you described of the flood in this town, this city, Tairen, that's what happened. You described exactly the way it looked. I'd never been in these places. Obviously, I wasn't there during the war. I'm not old enough, just was not born you know, 19. It wasn't 20 in 1940. So that was surprising to me. Now, here's over time, here's what's happened. I was staying at a hotel a few years ago with Lisa C., another writer. We were doing research together. She was very methodical, and I was like, well, whatever comes, that'll be research. And checking in, and there was a knock at the door. We were staying actually in a hotel that was the former mansion clubhouse of the gangster, the greatest gangster, the worst gangster in Shanghai history in the 20s and 30s who went to my mother's wedding. Knock at the door, and there was a bellhop, and he had my luggage, and he turned over the tags, and he said, Amy Tan? And I said, yes. And he's talking in English, and he said, the Amy Tan? And I thought, yes, it's my luggage. And he says, the Amy Tan, the writer? And he said, you wrote the Joy Luck Club? He said, that's my favorite book. I love that book. I read that book three times. He's saying this all in English. And I said, you read that book in English? Of course. Okay, so that, I have never had a bellhop in the United States ask me the Amy Tan. So there you go. I found that a lot of journalists who went through school learning English, that they were assigned some of my books, and so it's, but I never assume that when I'm in China that people would have read my books. You know, I'm not that vain or narcissistic that I would ever think that. When I do hear about it, I have never heard anybody say you got it wrong.
Some secrets are meant to be kept secrets. I wonder if you've lost friendships over your unraveling of a secret that they think that their recollection was different than yours. Could you talk about that?
You know, the secrets that I've written about, it would be my version of what happened, or my multiple versions of what happened with my grandmother. I had discovered something over the, you know, in recent years, a photograph that made me think she had been a courtesan. That's a terrible thing to say, you know, to even think, for me to even, you know, I could imagine her standing next to me being furious that I would ever think that if it had not been true. And there were so many coincidences that were happening, though, to, you know, kind of lend credence to this idea, and I had to say, oh, is this the fictional mind wanting to find justification to go in that direction, or is she throwing me clues to tell this secret in a certain way? That was a secret that has other people, you know, other people have a notion of my grandmother that's very sacred. So it'd be some of my cousins, or, you know, my some of the older relatives. And they were, one cousin was very upset that I would even suggest that. And she lives in Beijing, and her father is my mother's brother, who rose up in the ranks of being a young communist, pledged to the communist the army. They were part of the you know, Liberation Army. Rose up to the ranks of Vice Secretary of Labor for all of China. You know, very patriotic. His mother had been his inspiration. And now for me to say she might have been a courtesan, I don't think that's inconsistent, you know, the desire to overcome a society, to destroy a society that subjugated women, whether they became concubines or courtesans. But this was a very sensitive thing, and I had to be reminded that even though I'm a modern woman, and I can look at this and say, society did this to her. She didn't go in because she had a lascivious kind of personality. She would have been a victim. I had to see it from her point of view. And then I went back and forth saying, well, would she have wanted to be remembered as a stranger, a quiet woman who had a few words? So I went back and forth through all this. Well, my cousin was angry at me, and I rightfully so, and yet I couldn't continue with this obvious lie that she was quiet, debated with this. I heard recently she's not so mad at me now. But I also told her that I've also gone through all the other permutations of what the truth might have been with this secret, that it could have been something as harmless as her dressing up once a year with her cousin in costumes, because it was just as fun as dressing up in a dominatrix costume once a year to go on stage and do something really racy and crazy. I have to think that I must have gotten that from her. She hasn't heard that version, but she's already said she understands, and she, you know, she's not mad at me. There's a danger in revealing a secret about families of a different culture from yours has different ramifications, and you have to think of the dead. You are an unreliable narrator for the dead, and you have to remember you can't make up the justification. So I do this, and with all of it, and all the feelings of being guilty and bad, and then also determined to find truth. And I will say I'm a very good keeper of secrets. When people confide in me, I don't tell secrets. So I do think it's important to keep people's confidences.
Also about secrets, what was your relationship to secrets as a child?
I was surrounded by secrets, and I didn't even know it. There were messages that were confusing. So one of them had to do with these warnings that my mother would give me about bad men and how they would destroy me. That warning didn't make any sense. You know, I'm 11. And she would say things like, don't let a boy kiss you, because if you do, maybe you can't stop. And then you're going to have a baby, and then you're going to be so ashamed you'll throw the baby in the garbage can, and then the police will come and they'll take you away to jail, and then you'll kill yourself. And then, now this was based on a secret. I didn't know what she was talking about. And I found, I didn't know she had been married before. She was married to my father, the minister. She had three children, my older brother, my younger brother, and me. She had been married before, and she left three daughters behind in China. That's a huge secret. Huge secret that her grandmother had killed herself. A huge secret that her husband, you know, was this playboy who brought home women and wanted her to sleep with, you know, all of them in the same bed. That she had been in jail. That she had been raised as an orphan. That her grandmother lived in shame. All of these things came in the way of these warnings and advice. You know, don't let somebody look down on you. If they do, you don't believe them. You know, you are your own person. Don't follow what everybody does. All of those warnings were on the basis of those things that she never told me. And it was great because, you know, as a writer, you get to think about that and be confused and all this contradiction going on, and then you get to write about it, and people end up buying it, you know, buying these books. Now, that is definitely, selling books is not my motivation for writing these. I think getting published is like, it's an impure way to look at your writing, yeah. But I think we all have ways that we've rewritten our lives. And those become the secrets, the things we excised. And there was a lot in my family. And my mother wanted these things to come out after a while. You know, I do have to say this about this man who was my mother's first husband. Why she would give me a warning as bad as that one is that she did try to kill herself so many times because this man was so horrible. Was an arranged marriage. He was a pilot. He was like a movie star. and he could have anybody he wanted, including movie stars. And she said he treated her like a sex machine. He held a gun to her head if she wouldn't sleep with him. He raped schoolgirls. He had his daughters bring home their schoolmates so he could rape them. That is an evil man, you know? Those are the secrets I didn't know, and they were very important. I don't know, maybe it wasn't important to know them. Maybe it was simply important to get that warning. And, you know.
Hi, I'm a high school English teacher lucky enough to read the Joy Luck Club alongside my students every year, so we don't often get a chance to ask authors questions, but is there any message you would pass along to a teenager today reading the Joy Luck Club for the first time, possibly reluctantly?
Well, first I would assure the reader that they had every right not to like every book that they read, and we all have our tastes in what, you know, what makes for a good reading. Reading should be enjoyable, and you know, inevitably you're going to have to read some things that have been assigned to you. One of the things you know, you can do in reading a story like that is just seeing if there's anything that makes that connects with your life. It's like a little game of seeing if the dots connect. And maybe not, you know, then maybe looking at something like, is there an image or a fact or something surprising you didn't know about? So it can be anything to make the book enjoyable. But there's no particular meaning that they need to get out of it. There's no right or wrong way to read it. I've had readers who have written very detailed explanations of the symbolism and, you know, the narrative structure, and I didn't know that, you know. So there's no right or wrong. Here's the thing about writing, too. We writers have our own reasons for writing. At least I do. And my writing is never to say, I want everybody to understand mothers and daughters or Chinese culture or whatever. I'm writing about what I don't know, these questions I have, moral questions. And I'm writing it in the guise of what I've experienced, you know, in the context of that. And you know, so what somebody gets out of that is going to be their own questions. And I think that's great. When kids, especially when kids read something and say, I know that feeling of being the outsider and not belonging, or being looked down upon, or my mother doesn't understand me and we never will. We have this bridge because of all these things. If they find that and they said, this is what the book means to me, that's terrific. I didn't write that for that person. I can't take credit if they have repaired a relationship with their mother or, you know, suddenly were infused with a love of literature and decided to become the greatest writer or literature professor in the world. I'm glad, you know, and that's their own doing based on what they got out of a book. The first thing I said, if you hate the book, that's fine with me. It's, you know, I don't like every book either.
One thing after reading all of your books that always sticks with me is your characters seem so real, like real people. And Quan from 100 Secret Senses is one of my favorite characters. And I was wondering if they seem real to you long past you, during the time you wrote, and if so, like, who sticks around the most? Who speaks to you still?
You know, in a strange way, They are not characters in how readers look at them, I think, because these characters are more like what I talked about when I became the third-person child that I was in the car. And it's a third person, but it's also me, and I'm viewing it, and I'm experiencing it. So that part of the character has always been with me. They're not separate. They're not a separate entity. But Quan, I like Quana. You know, that personality is a lot like my mother and how I imagine my grandmother to have been, and probably a lot like me. Some of the characters, I will say, just seem more like my mother, and those are ones that I'm very fond of, like Lindo, the mother in the Joy Luck Club, whose daughter is a chess prodigy. That character is so much like my mother. But that's the reason why I'm very fond of her.
I am so sorry to say we are out of time. Please join us upstairs for the book signing. Ladies and gentlemen, Amy Tin.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.